very allegorical, which is almost taking metaphors over the top. I mean, it's applying a metaphor too much to almost every aspect of something. And in the ancient church, in the early church fathers, they particularly did this with the Song of Solomon. Allegorical meant that the book is almost predominantly symbolic. And so the various language and words used are referring not so much to sexual things or not so much to romantic love, but more to things like God's love for his people, God's love for Israel. So, for example, one church father, Cyril of Alexander, who lived from 375 to 444 AD, he actually thought that the woman's two breasts that are depicted in the Song of Solomon referred to the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, that's overly allegorical, right? Like, I really don't think that that's what was the intended meaning of that. But this is the way some of these early church fathers approached Scripture. That doesn't mean everything they wrote was terrible and wrong. We can learn some things from the early church fathers. I love a lot of Augustine's writings. But sometimes they took an overly allegorical interpretation. So a better way to interpret this book and to understand this book is that it's a love song and that it's really celebrating romantic love between a husband and a wife. And evidence points to the first century Jews seeing this song this way and interpreting it this way. And this view has come to be the predominantly accepted view today. Now that's not to say, though, that there's not analogies and that there's not metaphors. There's a lot of them in this book. And it's not to say that we can't make applications, which you're going to see. I'm going to give you a foreshadow. I'm just going to tell you now. I'm going to make an application that is appropriate of how this can point towards God's love for his people. But that's not the primary point of the book, and that's not the prime focus of it. That's not the context of what this is about. The context of what this is about is love and sex in the context of marriage. Listen to these helpful comments by Dennis Kinlaw, who writes in the Expositor's Bible Commentary on the Song of Solomon. And I have about four slides here. Let's listen to this lengthy quote as he kind of describes the book. Why is this seemingly erotic little book included in the sacred canon? What is its message? Part of the answer is that it speaks of an order of creation that is both pedagogical and eschatological. It speaks of marriage as it ought to be. The Bible does not see marriage as an inferior state, a concession to human weakness, nor does it see the normal physical love within that relationship as necessarily impure. Marriage was instituted before the fall by God, with the command that the first couple become one flesh. Therefore, physical love within that conjugal union is good, is God's will, and should be a delight to both partners. Proverbs 5, 15 through 19, and 1 Corinthians 7, verse 3. The prospect of children is not necessary to justify sexual love in marriage. Significantly, the Song of Solomon makes no reference to procreation. It must be remembered that the book was written in a world where a high premium was placed on offspring, and a woman's worth was often measured in terms of the number of her children. Sex was often seen with reference to procreation, yet there is not a trace of that here. The song of songs in praise is a song in praise. The song is a song in praise of love for love's sake and for love's sake alone. This relationship needs no justification beyond itself. End quote. That's the end of the commentator's quote. So we could sum up the primary point of this book then, the main theme as being love and sex in the context of marriage, that being a gift of God. One can see in the Song of Solomon as well a reflection back to Genesis chapters 1 and 2 in the Garden of Eden, prior to sin entering the world, whereby a man and a wife, we have the first marriage, and it says that the two become one flesh. There's a beauty to love and sex in the marriage that God has fully intended from the beginning of creation. The Song of Solomon presents some challenges in specific interpretation. So as you interpret this book, as you study this book, there are significant challenges in interpreting the book. One challenge relates to the language itself that's used. In these 117 verses in this book, there's a great deal of words that are only used once in the whole Bible. In the 470 words used in the book, 50 of them are words only used once in the Bible. That presents challenges to the meaning of certain words. We have to try to understand what those words meant, not just in the context, but what's the broader use of those words in writings that we may have from this time period, other writings, and we don't have a lot of other writings from this time period. So it can present some challenges to the meaning of certain words. Another challenge is just the genre of Hebrew poetry in general. Hebrew poetry was very, very much symbolic at times. There's terseness to it, or conciseness. It's very terse and concise, saying a lot in this very few words. All these things can make interpretation difficult, more difficult than if it was just like a narrative exposition. Like we see, okay, then Jesus went and did this. Like we've been seeing in Matthew, we've been seeing a lot of narratives. Poetry is very different, right? Words are used that in the original language rhyme, and they, you know, almost like a song with a chorus, right? The words sort of, you know, I was driving to church this morning listening to a worship song, and it's the one version, the contemporary version of it as well, and this line struck me. It said, "The wind and waves still know his name." And you've heard this song probably, "Wind and waves still know his name." And I just meditated on that for a while. I was like, that's an incredible line. What a great line. The wind and waves still know his name. And you can see the alliteration, the wind and waves, you know, the W's, you know, and they still know his name. Of course, referring to Jesus calming the storm and things like that. So in Hebrew poetry, you have similar words, similar sounds that were utilized. And sometimes when you translate that into English, it gets a little tricky to interpret the meaning. Another challenge is, yes, all the symbolism. And understanding the symbolism, too, as to what that symbolism may have meant in that culture, in that time period, such symbolism may be very different from what such words might mean in our culture, in our time period today. So words are used to illustrate, phrases are used to symbolize, and often, again, in a context here that's talking about love and the sexual relationship, and attraction and things like that. The word choices and phrases are very different than we might use in our world today. So for example, okay, let me just, men, gentlemen, give you a few pointers right here. If you're dating someone or pursuing a woman, or if you're married and you're wanting to express your romantic interest to said lady, it would probably be wise for you not to quite use these exact phrases. For example, I don't advise you saying to her, "Your neck is like the Tower of David." Nor do I recommend that you say, "Your belly is a heap of wheat." "Your teeth are like a flock of ewes." And here's one, "Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon." Don't say that. Your nose, it's like a tower. I'm not sure she would find that very romantic. But in that day and age, these words meant a lot. That was like on the Valentine's Day card, you know. That meant a lot. She's like crying, like, "Oh my gosh, my belly's a heap of wheat and my teeth are like a flock of ewes. You're so romantic." Well, now that we've talked about all the background of the book, let's look at some of the text a little more itself. The book's 8 chapters long, so obviously I'm not going to go through verse by verse like I usually do. I'm going to try to give kind of an overview. I'm going to do that by pulling out what I see are 7 themes. We're going to look at 7 themes this morning from the Song of Solomon that relate to love and intimacy. Are you ready? Number 1, deep desire. What is desire? Desire can be defined as, I quote, "a strong feeling of wanting something or wishing for something to happen." That's from our wonderful online version of dictionary. And the desire, I think, is appropriate to understand. It can be applied to someone, not just to something, right? And clearly in the Song of Solomon, we see deep desire that the man and the woman have for one another. Included in this deep desire is, of course, sexual intimacy. But it's best not to limit it only to that. Though the book's talking a lot about that, when it expresses their desire here, it's not only just for the physical act itself of sexual intimacy. By no means. It includes that, but it's not only that. So it would be wrong for us to reduce this idea of deep desire only to the physical aspects. Desire, deep desire, tends to be a lot more than desire for just physical intimacy. Desire, in other words, is typically more than lust or sex. Deep desire has a lot more to do with personal connection and relationship. Some have suggested, and I think very appropriately, that the allure that some people have towards things like pornography or to sexual intimacy outside the boundaries that God's given in marriage between one man and one woman, some have suggested, and again, I think very appropriately, that it's actually that urge or that deep desire for that is actually really less about the sex itself. And it's a lot more about feeling wanted, feeling desired. And someone that you're imagining is granting you that deep desire. Or on some level, you're experiencing, a person engaging in this is experiencing, I'm not saying you, but a person is believing this lie that it's giving them that. The allure of that at the core of it is this longing to feel wanted, to feel connected with someone, to be desired, and to have desire expressed. You see, where this is coming from is that God's created us for relationships. And desire is a very real thing, but that desire, even sexual desire, is ultimately intended to drive us towards relationship. And particularly within the boundaries God gives, the relationship between one man and one woman in marriage, in a covenantal committed relationship. But desire in and of itself is not a wrong thing. Longman and Allender write, and I quote, "The desire to be captured by delight is one of the most lovely and holy desires of our heart." The desire to be captured by delight is one of the most lovely and holy desires of our heart. So, of course, desire can be misdirected. The Song of Solomon shows us, this song shows us an appropriate direction for that desire. An appropriate direction being in the marriage relationship. Let's look at a few examples of how desire is expressed in this book. This is the Shulamite woman speaking. She says this, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth." Chapter 1, verse 2. "Let me see your face, let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely." Chapter 2, verse 14. "I held him and would not let him go." Chapter 3, verse 4. "I am my beloved's and his desire is for me." Chapter 7, verse 10. Those are just a few examples. And what you might have noticed just from these four examples is that in each one, this is the woman speaking and expressing her desire for the man, Solomon. Perhaps people might think that desire is mainly something that, you know, comes up in men, that, you know, men are just the ones desirous of intimacy or sex, and they're the ones that have this uncontrollable drive for that. What's interesting here is that this book tells us that desire is something that women very much have as well. And it's appropriate for a woman to express and pursue such desire towards her husband. Now, desire is not only expressed by the bride to Solomon, it's also expressed by Solomon to the Shulamite woman, his bride. He says this, "You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace." And sister, in this sense, is not some type of incestuous thing. It's almost like saying a sister in Christ, like we say today, or part of the, you know, closeness of our relationship, and it's like we're a part of a family. It's not meant to be anything beyond that. But he's captivated. You see that word twice there in this verse. And this deep desire is something so evident in their relationship. And it's ultimately a desire, again, not just for sex, though that's part of it, but a desire for that close connection and that intimate, holistic relationship. The second theme that we see in the book is beholding beauty. We've seen deep desire. Now we see beholding beauty, number two. You might know the proverb well at the very end of the book of Proverbs concerning the excellent wife in Proverbs 31, this verse 30. It says, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised." And some might read that and kind of, you know, think, well, you know, beauty's not really that important. Beauty's just, you know, what really matters, not how we're physical beauty, that's not important at all. It's the inner person of the heart. It's the woman who fears the Lord. She's to be praised. And that our beauty, that's just vain. But beauty in and of itself is not something the Song of Solomon dismisses or disregards. Rather, it exalts it in a lot of ways. It highlights it. And so, nothing against Proverbs 31, verse 30. I quote that a lot to people, that outward beauty is not as important as the inward person of the heart. But at the same time, it's not wrong to appreciate outward beauty either. And again, my point here, my theme is beholding beauty. So hang in there with me and let me explain where I'm going with this. But let's look first at how beauty is shown to be significant and wonderful, how it's lifted up and exalted even in this book. There's multiple times when Solomon admires her beauty. Look at what Solomon says about her. He says, "You, O most beautiful among women," chapter 1, verse 8. "Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful," chapter 1, verse 15, and he repeats it in chapter 4, verse 1. "As a lily among brambles, so is my love among the young women," chapter 2, verse 2. And then walk with me down through all of the details in chapter 4. In chapter 4, he mentions her eyes are like doves, her hair like a flock of goats, her teeth like a flock of ewes. We've joked about this already, but her lips are like a scarlet thread, her mouth is lovely, her cheeks are like pomegranates, her neck like a tower, her breasts like two fawns that graze among the lilies. Then he sums it all up saying, "You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you." Chapter 4, verse 7. Then in chapter 6, he doesn't stop. He continues, "You are beautiful as Tirzah." That's a city, a really beautiful city. "You are beautiful as Tirzah, my love. Lovely as Jerusalem. Awesome as an army with banners." This is a dude, so he's thinking war. You know, he's like, "You're like an awesome army. You're even better." He was playing with his little army men when he was a kid, and "You're even cooler than that." He continues, "Beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun." He repeats it, "Awesome." He likes an army with banners. Chapter 6, verse 10. And then here's one. "How beautiful are your feet in sandals. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand." She's a work of art. Now, all this just to say or prove, it's not intended to just prove that, oh, well, you know, men, they're just more visual. You know, they're just more, you know, lustful and visual and all that, you know, and research has been done that men are a little more visually inclined. But it's not saying that this is wrong. It's not saying that he's just overly enamored with her physical beauty. Don't dismiss the things that he's saying here as inappropriate. It's something he's rejoicing in, it's something he's enjoying, and it's directed in the right way to the woman that he loves, that he's married or about to marry. Furthermore, what's important to realize is that, I don't want you to miss this, that beauty is very much in the eye of the beholder. He sees her this way. She becomes his standard of beauty. I mean, he described her as being without any flaw. Look, undoubtedly she had some kind of flaw. You know, he might have viewed her as without a flaw, but there's no way that she was perfect. And just as there's no way that whoever's considered the most beautiful woman in the world or the most beautiful model in the world or whatever, there's no way that she's perfect. Or that vice versa, that a male model or a male, you know, most handsome man in the world is perfect. But to him, he's gushing about her. Yes, he's like a groom crying, watching his bride come down the aisle. He's overflowing with affection for her. He's head over heels for her, for who she is, yes. But included in this admiration is her physical beauty in his eyes. How appropriate it is for him here to praise her and express his admiration of that beauty that he sees of who she is and of his admiration of her beauty in his eyes. Now, guys, maybe you're thinking, you know, I'm not all that romantic, you know, and Valentine's Day, that's just, you know, you're like that guy in the beginning that, you know, you've committed that terrible thing of saying it's overrated and I'm not really into Valentine's Day and that kind of thing. You're thinking, man, I don't need to tell the girl that I love or the girl that I like how much I care about her, what I love about her, how beautiful she is to me. Well, Solomon would like to ask you to step outside. He'd like to have a little, he's not going to beat you up. He'd like to have a little chat with you because right here, he does the opposite of that. So look, my default mode, ask my wife, is not to gush over her like this. But Song of Solomon tells us, men, this is an appropriate thing for us to do. And like we taught our kids when we were little, when they were trying to express themselves, use your words. Use your words. Men, use your words. Oh, she knows already. I work so hard. I bring home the bacon. She knows how much. Use your words. Song of Solomon would tell us so, right? It's something appropriate that we ought to do as men to the woman we love. Beholding beauty is something the Shulamite woman also expresses to Solomon as well. Look at what she says about him. Behold, you are beautiful, my beloved, truly delightful. Chapter 1, verse 16. As an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among young men. Chapter 2, verse 3. And then just like chapter 4, where he was gushing about her, watch the way she describes him in chapter 5. In chapter 5, she says, his eyes are like doves beside streams of water. His cheeks are like beds of spices. His lips are lilies. His arms are rods of gold set with jewels. His body is polished ivory bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns. He just finished leg day at the gym, I guess. His appearance is like Lebanon as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. He is altogether desirable. This is my beloved. And don't miss this part. This is my friend. Once again, there are clear admirations of beauty, and much of it is physical. Physical is included in this. But notice its beauty as she beholds beauty. In chapter 5, verse 10, and I didn't put this on the slide, verse 10 begins all of this. She says, my beloved is distinguished among 10,000. To her, you could line up 10,000 men, and she said, that guy, that one, my husband, that's the one that's the most handsome of them all, the most beautiful of them all. It's in the eye of the beholder. He becomes her standard of beauty. He's altogether desirable to her. And it's not only physical beauty, as significant as that is here. Notice in verse 16 how it ends this lengthy description of his beauty by calling him her friend. You see, again, it's not just physical alone. It's about their relationship. Ladies, you talk to the man that you love like this, and he'll feel like he can climb Mount Everest. He'll feel like he can swim the English Channel. He'll feel like Superman. Not maybe in an arrogant way. You don't want him to feel in an arrogant way. But in a way that no matter what's going on around him, he can handle it with God's grace. Because he knows he has your confidence, your respect, your encouragement. That you are that helper fit for him. And he feel like he can tackle anything. He'll run through a wall. He knows that you see him, that you adore him. and it means an incredible amount to him. So we've seen deep desire. We've seen beholding beauty. Let's look at our third theme in the Song of Solomon, passionate pursuit. The man and the woman pursue one another throughout this book. Here's an example of him pursuing her. He says, "Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away." You see that invitation there, that pursuit. He repeats it, chapter 2, verse 10, and chapter 2, verse 13. And then there's her to him. She says, "I sought him whom my soul loves. I will seek him whom my soul loves." Chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. What do they pursue? Well, amidst all the things in the world that people pursue, clearly here they are pursuing one another. And they're doing so very intentionally. They're initiating connection. They're initiating time together. They're even initiating intimacy with one another. Now, it's appropriate to initiate intimacy. Absolutely. And notice here that the pursuit of intimacy is reciprocal. They both initiate towards one another at times. And this could be in general in their relationship, holistically, in all the different aspects. Something to take from this is that, look, if one person in the relationship is the one doing all the initiating or the overwhelming majority of the initiating, whether that's for conversation, whether that's for time together, whether that's for relationship development, whether that's for activities together, whether that's even sexual intimacy, if one person's predominantly doing the initiating, that person starts to get a little weary of doing it. Because there's not reciprocation, and they feel like they're mostly doing the work for the relationship. You know, they're mostly the one prioritizing the relationship. And they'll start to sort of gradually diminish in their intentionality towards that. Often is what happens. But when both people initiate, when both people are pursuing one another, there's this wonderful synergy, if you will. There's something that just sort of energizes the relationship, and it's almost like interest that builds in an investment account. It momentum builds because the relationship energizes more and more because there's a mutual sense of love and support and effort and encouragement that makes the overall relationship healthier and frankly makes it a lot more enjoyable. Passionate pursuit. The fourth theme we see in the Song of Solomon is the glories of the garden. What do I mean by this? Well, I alluded to earlier how the Song of Solomon sort of reflects back to God's intended purpose for the marriage that's in Genesis 1 and 2 in the first marriage. The Song of Solomon shows us the way intimacy in marriage is intended to be from the very beginning. And in Genesis 1 and 2, of course, the first marriage occurred and where they lived in the Garden of Eden. In the Song of Solomon, a garden and all kinds of things related to a garden, of what's produced in a garden, are used as metaphors again and again and again. They're used all over the place in the book in reference to intimacy, holistically, and especially in reference to sexual intimacy between Solomon and his bride. So, for example, look at what she says to him. Chapter 4, verse 16. "Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits." She's not talking about the backyard garden where they have a little tomato vine or a grapevine. She's not. She's talking about, let's be together. And then he says to her, "I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk." These are all metaphors, I think, that's ways of describing and the wonders of their consummation of their marriage. And even others, so the backup singer, so to speak, the friends of the bride, "Eat, friends, drink, be drunk with love," as if they're sort of celebrating their union and their wedding together. By the way, I kind of came across this accidentally yesterday. I was just in all my wonderful free time. I happened to scroll through some videos on YouTube, and I think I was looking at some worship songs or something, and I saw this heading that caught my attention: "Holy Spirit hits a wedding." Holy Spirit falls on a wedding or something like that. And I was like, oh, cool, I do a lot of weddings. I'll see what this is about. And I click it, and it just shows the bride and groom, and the pastor's kind of in front of them. And I guess the worship, there's like a guy playing a guitar who's kind of, you can't really see, but kind of in the background. And they're playing this worship song. It's a well-known one, but the song itself is not what's important. What was so incredible is that for like a good like 5 to 7 minutes, they're just worshiping God in this wedding. And it was so fun to watch. Like, the groomsmen in particular were really getting into it. And the bride was getting into it. And the bridesmaids were holding flowers. But they seemed like they were expressing worship and awe of God, too. And the pastor, like, I was really laughing at the pastor. Like, he's like, this is the best wedding I've ever been to at all. Everybody's worshiping. He's, like, kind of jamming. It's just, it was incredible. And they were just exalting in the presence of God being the center of this couple's life for their marriage. It's like the others here saying, eat friends, drink, be drunk with love. They're celebrating the love that God has given them and praying that, and essentially in worshiping God, that he would be central in their marriage and in their relationship. It was a beautiful thing. And here, expressed in the Song of Solomon, and I only gave you 3 verses as examples. They're all over the place in this book. The glories of the garden is the metaphor for the glories of sexual intimacy in the context of marriage. It's all over the place in this book. This couple is experiencing the blessings and joys of sexual intimacy. It's celebrating it as a gift from God. The 5th theme we see in the book is facing the foxes. What is that? Facing the foxes. Look with me in chapter 2, verse 15, where we see this phrase. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. What does this verse mean? I'm going to go to Allender and Longman. They very helpfully describe this. First, they say a fox is a pest that in ancient literature, as well as in our day, is a shrewd adversary and nearly impossible to catch. To be told to catch a fox is like being told to go catch a professional Ocean's 11-style thief. Keeping the vineyard safe from harm requires immense wisdom and intense vigilance. To preserve sexual joy, one must have the perseverance of a gardener who daily weeds her garden and the wisdom of the serpent, thereby outfoxing the foxes in protecting her hard-earned grapes. Allender and Longman continue. Who are the foxes? What do they represent? Most likely, the specific referent to this metaphor is intended to be vague and ambiguous. Or to put it more positively, the foxes stand for anything or anyone who threatens the harmony and well-being of the vineyard garden. That is, anything or anyone who represents danger to the intimate relationship between the man and the woman. The possibilities for the identification of the foxes are endless, and the principle is clear. There are forces, people, things that make it difficult to achieve the physical intimacy celebrated in the song. Did you catch all that? To catch the foxes is to keep the things that would hinder and get in the way from experiencing the connection in the marriage that God has designed for the marriage to occur, which isn't just physical, but physical is definitely a big part of it. So foxes could be things like sexual immorality, past or present. Foxes could be things like pornography, lust. It could be things like past abuse. It could be any sexual problems or struggles, whether physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, or medical, that sometimes occur. But foxes, as defined here intentionally ambiguously, can even include things that in and of themselves might not be wrong, but are just kind of crowding out the prioritization of the couple. What could those kinds of things be that could crowd out marital connection and intimacy? Work? This? You know, there was an artist that took some pictures where he photoshopped out the phone. He took pictures of, like, I don't know how he did this. I want to say it was like a couple willing to kind of model this, of like in the bedroom, and they're just like, you know, and they're turned facing away from each other, and they're staring at their cell phones. Do you know there's been studies done that couples that bring cell phones into the bedroom and keep it there tend to have less physical intimacy? It's true. Research was done on televisions too. Televisions get in the way. And again, we're not talking about only physical intimacy, though I'm using that as an example here. Communication diminishes. I mean, sadly, so often more couples look at this thing than they talk to each other. I've been guilty of it. You know? So, recreation, hobbies, busyness of life, anything that takes precedence and priority over the marriage could be a fox that you need to not allow come into the garden and cause some damage. Now look, some couples have significant struggles when it comes to sexual intimacy. And there's a variety of reasons for that. And some of those struggles are beyond one's control, certainly. And this is not to make such couples struggling in this area feel worse about it. This is talking about the things that one can intentionally do to prevent something from impeding this area of the couple's relationship. The Song of Solomon displays this God-ordained beauty and gift of love and intimacy in marriage. So as far as it depends on couples, face the foxes. Don't allow them as much as you can, by God's grace, to get in the way of what God has for intimacy in marriage. The sixth theme in the Song of Solomon, longing for love. Now, this may seem like it's similar to deep desire, but I have a little bit of different emphasis I'm going to put on this. Longing for love is a God-given thing because God, again, has made us relational beings. We're created first and foremost to be in a relationship with Him. Yet He's created us to be in relationship with other people. And the longings for relationship can be powerful. And when those longings are not met, they're not experienced, one can feel very lonely. Prior to marriage, people can feel very lonely. In marriage, people can feel very lonely. Regarding sexual desire, these powerful longings must not be pursued or expressed outside of the boundaries God gives for sex in the context of marriage between one man and one woman. Relational over-attachments as well, not just physical attachments, must have certain constraints so as not to become unhealthy, where one finds one's identity and fulfillment in another person or is overly dependent on another person. On these notes, the Song of Solomon repeats a refrain three times. Do not stir or awaken love until it pleases. Chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, and chapter 8, verse 4. What does this mean? Well, it's typically understood as not entering into physical intimacy prior to being married or outside of the marriage, and that's a very appropriate application. Certainly, a couple may feel longings and towards one another and feel that they're in love, and therefore restraint in the physical area is just almost dismissed. And our culture is increasingly doing that, where people are living together and having sex outside of marriage. But the Song of Solomon says, do not stir or awaken love until it pleases. And so certainly this applies to physical aspects of the relationship. But one could say, beware of building as well an unhealthy attachment or an overdependence on someone else, especially prior to entering into a complete covenantal commitment of marriage. One could say, you know, slow things down a little bit. Let the relationship develop. Don't rush into things because we're in love and there's not a real healthy understanding and knowing the person. The longing for love as well that we feel must be placed in the proper perspective even within marriage. The many powerful expressions in the Song of Solomon might lead someone to think that, whether prior to marriage or in marriage, to think that love and sex is just the end-all be-all. And it's not. Though you have a real longing for love that each and every person has, we must be careful of feeling like love and sex and marriage is going to fully meet and satisfy all of that longing. You know, this could work a couple of ways. One could be a person who's not married could be so eager for the marriage, and then once they're married, they're actually kind of disappointed because it didn't quite meet their expectations. It didn't fully and completely and finally satisfy them. One could be in the marriage and be disappointed as well because they had that unreasonable expectation. The longings for love are very real, but they can be misunderstood and misapplied. Love and sex are very powerful things. They must be placed, though, in the proper perspective. Now, listen to some descriptions of how real and powerful love is and these longings for love as they're portrayed in the book. Look at me at chapter 8. In chapter 8, verse 6, it says, "Love is as strong as death." And in chapter 8, the title of my sermon this morning is derived, says, "Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it." Love is powerful, folks. It's so powerful that people long for it. It can be strong, stronger than death, so strong that many waters cannot quench it. It's like waters that cannot put out a campfire. It's like waters that cannot put out a forest fire. Such longings can have some degree of fulfillment in marriage and sex, but not fully and finally and ultimately. It is here at the very end of the book that, ironically, death is mentioned. Death is going to occur. There's not going to be heaven on earth just by being married and having sex or being in a relationship. It alludes to love here in this chapter, and it doesn't allude to it, it states it. And marriage and sexual love is in the context of this book is something significant, yes, but love and sex are not ultimately, fully, and finally satisfying. It's not the end-all, be-all. Love and sex are just a glimpse, as wonderful they are, of something even greater. And that leads us to our seventh and final theme, and I'm almost done, folks. The seventh and final theme is the bridegroom and his bride, also known as Christ and the church. Though we don't want to take an allegorical interpretation to the book and say that this book is only about that, the theme of marital love and intimacy and sex in the context here of this book points towards a greater thing, and that is God's love for his people. The bridegroom, Jesus Christ, who will come for his bride, the church. And Revelation tells us about this great marriage supper of the Lamb that is to come, where God's going to gather his people from east and from west, from north and south, from the four ends of the earth. And there'll be this great marital banquet feast. So though Song of Solomon is not primarily a metaphor of Christ and the church, it does point towards that. Love finds its ultimate expression in God because God is love. And God demonstrates his love for you and me. He pursues you and me. Even though we are sinners, he dies for us. The extent to which his love is stronger than death because he rose from the dead. He died to pay for your sin. He rose from the dead to give you a relationship with him where your longing for love can only fully and finally be found. So let me close with three final thoughts. First, I want to speak to you who are married. Then I'm going to speak to those of you who are not married. And then I want to speak to those of you who maybe will never marry, or those of you maybe who have been married but have lost a loved one. First, to those of you who are married, love and sexual intimacy should be a central aspect of your relationship. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 3 says, "Do not deprive one another." It doesn't need to be everything in your relationship, nor should it be, but it does need to be a part of your relationship. This wonderful book, you can see that God has established love and sex in the marriage relationship as a gift, as a blessing, and part of his divine purposes. So a view that considers love and sex as unimportant, and I hear this from time to time in my counseling practice, especially over the 15 plus years I think it's been that I've been doing it, you know, one spouse will say, "Well, that's just not really important to me. I'm just not really into that part of our relationship." And I think that's a misapplication of the biblical precedent for it to be part of your relationship. And if there are struggles there, those need to be worked through as much as possible. So to take a view that considers love or sex in the marriage relationship as unimportant or unnecessary is rejecting a biblical perspective of what God has intended for the marriage relationship. God has given you who are married love and sex in marriage for your joy, for your pleasure, and ultimately for his glory, as your intimacy foreshadows and points towards the greater glory to come in Christ and the church. Second, let me speak to those of you who are not married. Hearing this sermon today may just stir those longings and desires to get married more and more. And maybe this has been hard for you to sit through. But this book, The Song of Solomon, is also for you because it can point you to prepare now to pursue a marriage where these realities can be experienced. You can right now not allow foxes to wreak damage into the garden or the vineyard of your life. Things that could damage you now and damage and create problems in your marriage later. Furthermore, the real and powerful sexual desires that you may feel and you may have can be appropriately directed to motivate you to pursue relationship. In 1 Corinthians 7, it literally says, because of sexual immoralities, get married. It's better to get married than to burn with desire or passion. In other words, I see that the sexual drive that God has appropriately given can drive one to pursue an appropriate relationship with a godly man or woman in the context of marriage. Not to stir, arouse, or awaken love before the time, but to pursue that and to eventually have that time or season of life where one is married, where the expressions of this can be more appropriately experienced. Lastly, to those of you who may never marry, and to those of you who maybe have lost a spouse and maybe are considering not remarrying ever, the Song of Solomon is still for you because it points to an even greater love and intimacy than any marriage can ever give you. It points to the full and final fulfillment that is found in your relationship with God through Jesus Christ. This wonderful gift of love and sexual intimacy points towards the ultimate gift of God's love for us in Christ in the gospel. Ephesians 5 even tells us the marriage reflects and points towards this greater reality of Christ and his love for his bride, the church. So too, the glories of love and sex described here are just a glimpse of something so much greater to come. And that's for all of us, regardless of our marital state, to rest in and to rejoice in. Let's pray. God, we thank you for including this book in your word to give us perspective that influences our practice of this important topic. God, I pray for my friends here. For those who are married, I pray for the wonderful joys of what you've given in marriage. For those who are not married, that this will be something that will be applicable to them and that they will hold to the God-given boundaries that you